Welcome everyone to our class, 5 20th Century Houses. My name is Matthew Schlube. I'm a registered architect. Been practicing for about 2 decades in residential architecture. And I am been teaching here at OSHA for several years. And I want to thank you for signing up for class today. It's really a pleasure for me to present this material to you, and I welcome feedback as well on the material, ways that you might think that I can improve the class, because the class is primarily for your benefit, although I'd make the argument that I get more out of it than you would. So with that, I hope that you, I emailed out yesterday a copy of the syllabus for the class. If you didn't receive that, just send me an email and I'll get that to you before next week's class. And with that, I guess we'll get started here. So I have an image on here that's not a 20th century house, as you may have gathered. Some of you might be tuned in yesterday. There was the Artemis with NASA was trying to launch a ship to the moon. We haven't been to the moon in over a century, half a century. And they delayed that launch. It's going to happen on Friday. You might want to tune in if you... you get a chance Friday, I think it's at 12:45, I think they're going to try to launch. But I have this up here because of the tie-in to today's, not only today's lecture, but also the course as a whole. But actually, before we get into that, I wanted to do a quick poll just to get some feedback. It's the question is, what is a house? So I have several answers for you here that you can choose from. And we'll run this here for a few minutes. Got about 50% response here. Coming in nicely though. Just a few more minutes here. So the as you're doing that, the title of the course, 5 20th Century Houses, is partly a on a personal note. There are houses that that have influenced my own education, development as an architect, my practice in residential architecture. I have a list of houses from the 20th century that inspire me in my work. And so I got the thought that maybe I could present a class on 20th century houses and illustrate and talk about some of these houses that I think are pretty significant in the kind of the course of architecture history. And so this first course that we're taking here is just 5 of them. It's the first 5 in on my list from the first decade of the 20th century. Today's house starting in 1901. But the idea is that I could teach subsequent semesters of these along the same lines and just kind of work chronologically through time to where next semester theoretically could be the second decade in the 20th century. And so each class is basically focusing on one particular house, one architect, and kind of going into them in a little bit more depth and with the idea that once this kind of series of classes is concluded, hopefully there'll be kind of some narratives and some arcs that you'll see carry through the 20th century that are illustrated by these houses as kind of like a closer lens on architecture. So with that, excuse me here just a minute, get a drink. See, most of you have taken the poll here, and we can get some results. So we have, looks like we have, so the, what is a house? The first option here, a shelter from the weather or outdoors, about 25% responded with that. Second one, an investment to create wealth. Nobody picked that one. A place to raise a family, about 3%. A home is a house. A familiar place to feel comfortable and safe and grounded was the most popular selection, about 64%. A house is a public facade, an outward expression or statement, socially or political, of your identity. Only about 3% on that one. And then here, the seventh one, which was a work of art, a living sculpture to inhabit, to enrich daily life. Only about 5% selected that. And then finally, an entertaining hobby. No one selected. And last, none of the above, 1%. Let's see here. With that, this ties in, it helps me to kind of gauge, it seems that a house is a home for most of the people here tuning in today, but it also is a little bit of a segue that we'll see as we go along here in the class towards today's lecture on Peter Brenn's house. And before we jump into that, just wanted to comment a little bit more on this Artemis ship here. We see at the top, this image on screen, we can see the capsule where the astronauts would sit on their way to the moon. You can see the moon here in the distance of the photograph. And the capsule is really kind of, in my mind, one way of defining a house or a home is kind of like the minimal essential unit that defines a form of architecture. It's kind of the smallest kind of basic unit, essential unit for living, which is what architecture provides for. But also we see here this spaceship built of these very modern materials, steel, these hybrid complex materials. And this is really one of the major themes on this course that we're going to be taking here over the next 5 weeks, is this idea of the advent of industrialization in the 1800s, new modern techniques, technologies, ways of building, as well as new materials, steel, concrete, glass. These types of things were all coming online in the mid-century, in the 1800s, towards the end, and really to a height right at the turn of the century. And that's where our class today picks up, seeing an example of Peter Brenn's house that is trying to walk this line between this transition from an industrial society that's coming online to this more romantic notion that they're still kind of clinging and holding on to from the past traditions. And so along those lines, metaphorically here, the spaceship that will be launching on Friday is also kind of doing a similar thing, kind of leaping off to the moon from the Earth. The Earth is kind of our home in a larger sense. And at the same time, we live in interesting times where we're in this transition moment, much like Peter Brenz found himself a century ago transitioning. We are transitioning off planet. And within our lifetime, I think we're going to see individuals inhabiting this moon we see off in the distance, as well as even further planets. With that, today's lecture, as I mentioned, covers Peter Brenz House of 1901 in Darmstadt, Germany. And next week, just to give you a little quick overview here, we'll get into Antonio Gaudi's Casa Batlló, which some of you might be familiar with if you've taken some of the Gaudi classes in the past that I've taught. But what's interesting is by having a whole class kind of focused on Casa Batlló, it'll get into a little bit more depth than in some of those classes in the past, as well as kind of also in the context of this course, which is really the point of this, you'll get to see how that house fits in to the larger kind of global arc of this industrialization that's not just happening here in the United States that we're familiar with living here in Pittsburgh, but really all over the world, as in Barcelona as well, a very industrial city. That'll be followed by some of you, Frank Lloyd Wright's Robie House, I'm sure you're familiar with. Similar thing, all these houses that we'll be looking at over the next 5 weeks is really at this larger narrative of this industrial transition that's happening. So with that, I wanted to give just real briefly here a little bit of background, concept, set of context for the stage in Germany at the time that Peter was making this house. And so just real quickly overview on some history. From 1815 to 1871, the German states that had survived Napoleon's reorganization of Central Europe started to accommodate the bourgeoisie's demands for representation, this kind of form of democratic rule, rather than the traditional aristocratic rule that really kind of was the precursor throughout history. And then in 1871, following the German reunification, there was the first chancellor, Otto Bismarck, and he enfranchised each male with equal voting ability. Each person's vote was equally weighted. They weren't weighted by economic position as some democracies had been set. And this really appealed to the masses, or I guess in this case, to the men that were voting, and brought about this kind of new form of populism. At the same time, there was this, as we were saying here, there was this rapid industrialization happening that were causing peasants to move from the outer rural lands where they lived off the more agrarian type lifestyle, into these urbanization that was rapidly happening as well to the cities centers where these factories were being built for this industrialization and employing these people. And this moved this populace to this new class of proletariats, this working class. And this was happening by the 1890s. That there was this migration to this urbanization. And then by 1912, just a few years after the house that we're looking at here today, this proletariat or this masses that kind of defined themselves as within Germany as the Social Democrats became the largest party, gaining 35% of the vote And it reached this pinnacle by doing so, to where the aristocrats that traditionally would rule the land no longer could command the loyalty of these people that were gaining power by their numbers. And so this called into question the kind of the traditional form of government, parliamentary rule within Germany, that they were losing control of. These people in their minds were becoming ungovernable. So this kind of undermines a more romantic notion within Germany that predates that, going back centuries, of this idea of this kind of this German myth of unity, which was kind of like the what was sold at the time in the 1871 for this German unification of these smaller states. This concept or this myth or idea that people that speaking the same language and that inhabit the same territory, people of different social classes even so, share the same interests. But what they were finding here was that this proletariat, this working class, did not share the same interests. And so there was a little bit of rebellion that was happening. Around 1929, the American stock market crashed, and this triggered an economic crash within Germany as well, and a rise in mass culture in alliance as a result of this economic crash to an avant-garde artist culture, where people turned to artists and these avant-garde individuals, poets and painters, to find solutions to their problems, since they no longer could rely on the political leaders in these times of economic collapse. And so they had this kind of hope from these artists for reconstituting a new ideal community as a result of this. Going back again to these 18th century kind of German romantic belief that art is a reflection of the society from which the art is produced. So this enabled, as a result of this, a new kind of social analysis of the process of modernization, or these qualities within this modern society of industrialization and urbanization, and the effects of that having this rise in this working class in a democratic state. All of these things were radically changing, not only politics, but social, but also just the way of life. And the real question for the artists at the time, Peter Brenz being the one that we're focusing on here today, was how would you address trying to solve these social problems in society by overlaying past forms onto the present conditions, these newfound modern conditions, or more radically, as we might see some examples here today, by inventing new versions of the old timeless ideals. And so one other aspect to point out here of this emergence of this mass public, this working class, is that this working class was able to, through their work, gain a little bit better economic conditions than as peasants previously out in the fields. And so they became consumers. And as a result, just by the sheer number of the quantity of people now in this consumer class, resulted in greater need and demand for things to be consumed. And so this brought on this idea of mass production of goods, that the old ways of producing goods by hand, one item at a time, could no longer suffice or keep up with this larger growing community of consumers. And so this brought about what really we're going to be focusing on today, is this idea of mass produced goods as through this industrial process of these machines that are coming online at the turn of the century. And as a result, through these mass-produced products and this populace, we're getting this populace culture or pop culture. At this time, at the turn of the century, there was a great interest in film and radio, sporting events, theater, and this was challenging kind of like the old aristocracy's form of entertainment or of consumerism within more of a civic kind of realm. And so this advent of pop culture, popular culture, really had an impact on which we're going to see here today. So, in 1888, prior to this industrial hold that's happening, William Morris in England really kind of spearheaded this movement referred to as the arts and crafts movement. And this was an idea of the traditional arts of making things by hand through these guilds. It was being outmoded or being pushed aside by these new machines that were coming online. And so there was a little bit of a backlash to that, to where individuals like William Morris were trying to hold on to these old historical means and methods. And so a lot of the art community, Peter Brenz being one of them, subscribed to this ideology. And so here we see a woodcut, an example of a woodcut from 1899. And this was done by Peter Brenz, titled Winter Landscape. And we see in here examples of the technique of this carving the wood to create prints, and the stylization of the subject matter as far as the line work that we see here. Let me see if I can get a pointer. You can see the movement that's created within the composition from the flowing line work, as well as also just the use of the dark and the light regions of the picture to create this sense of depth, and creating this enclosure here that he's framing by the landscape around it, to draw you in to this center point here. But more significantly, the reason why this type of artwork appealed to Peter was this idea of line and using lines as a compositional, non-objective type form of artwork. And this was to use lines at almost like as a mechanism to solicit a psychological response to the viewer that's taking in the artwork. It's this idea of creating almost a pure form of art that has this response, almost a precursor to these abstract type artwork that we're familiar with later in the century, to where the lines become the composition of the piece more so than the narrative or the imagery that we're seeing here that's created as well in a more painterly traditional way. This also tied directly in with Nietzsche, which is also speaks to a German history of having culture spring from the ground or from the life itself, not something that's based in a positivic type education or but something that is that's brought about from life's experiences. As he was quoted as saying, is give me life and I will soon make you a culture out of it. So The work of art must be removed from its isolation in a museum or in a salon, and in this case, creating a decoration for an environment was seen as a higher role for them to painting and sculpture to impact society through as artwork out in daily life, as opposed to into these traditionally these cultural institutions. And so one of the primary goals of this was to construct a better society nurtured by this these works of art that are being created. We see here Peter's house from 1901 again. This is the front facade, and you can see the much like his woodcuts, you can see the lines that are reflected or animated on the surface to create this movement within composition within the house, beyond just a form of decoration or a application of ornaments to the surface. This idea of use of line was something that was pushed by many of the other artists in the groups that Peter frequented with, one of which we'll see be seen later in the fifth week of this course, Henry Vandeveld, his own house. But there also was kind of like this polarization within the art community between the line and also geometric form and shape, which was supported by Josef Olbricht and Charles McIntosh, were really kind of the two big proponents of this. This use of line, though, appealed more so than the geometric form for Peter. We do see some kind of geometric stylization here in the front door of the house. But more significantly, it's dominated by the green brick columns here and pilasters flanking the door and framing the door, creating this very strong vertical line just in the way that the brick is laid in, scalloping. And this also speaks to another concept, German concept from Richard Wagner within music. Some of you may be familiar with this concept of a total work of art, or in German, I guess, Kunstwerk, and the where the artwork is a combination of many pieces that are brought together to create this holistic form of art. In this case, the artists, like Peter, push themselves within to architecture to create this all-encompassing artwork that you could inhabit beyond just a woodcut on the wall. And so there was this belief that that this could be a transformative power of art in the human being as well as in society to elevate their existence in all dimensions. So we see here his desire within his house to do this. And so we see just this combination of the brickwork as well as the within the front door, the engravings here as the glasswork over top. All of these different trades are coming together, showcasing their work in a combination that creates a complete whole. That being the house. And this is this idea of a total work of art that he was trying to find. So just to give some context of where this house is located, the Grand Duke of Hesse, Ernest Ludwig, founded what he referred to as an artist colony within his county of Hesse. And this was an idea that was promoted by a few publishers in the region that were trying to recognize the contemporary awakening of the applied arts in Germany. And they pushed Ludwig to use this artist colony as a vehicle to preempt the more larger cities like Munich that were economically thriving as a result of the arts. And by focusing or creating this artist community here in his homeland, he could create an example or an exhibition of how the arts could really support and fuel this kind of new way or union of life in art. These artists being an example of this within the works. And so he invited seven artists, painters and sculptors, and one architect to come to Darmstadt in 1899. And this included Josef Olbricht, who was Viennese and very well known as a secessionist, this leader of this movement back in Vienna. He was the only architect that came in the group, and as well as Peter Brenz was also invited, and he was of some local fame at the time for his inclusion in the, more of the decorative arts, and we'll see some examples of that here as we go along. But they were to design as well as build and then furnish these houses that they were going to create in this little artist community. And very few limitations placed on the work. They needed to create a studio space within this house that they could create their work in. And so this this development of this artist community concept as an exhibition. Here we're seeing a site plan of this this layout, and you can see these dark pieces here are the seven houses that were created for each one of the artists, as well as this cross axis through the main street here that sets up this more prominent location of the Duke's house here, the larger house here at the top of the hill, as well as down at the bottom of the hill, there was a exhibition space where they could put on these art performances to attract, again, this exhibition of examples of how art could be kind of infused into daily life to try to elevate the people. We see here also on this plan here over on the left-hand side, this is Peter's house. It's off in the corner, southwestern end of the street. And despite the fact that Olbricht, the Viennese architect, him being an architect, he designed all of the houses within the development, as including the Duke's house. But Peter designed his own house, and so he was kind of the sole exception. He had been trained, Peter had been trained more of a painter, classically trained, and he also had done some jewelry and other types of industrial type design in other objects, but not had never ventured off into architecture. And so this was his first foray, was this house that we're taking a look at here today. Once the houses were complete, which was in 1901, there was an opening in May 15th of 1901, and to celebrate this new artist community and to draw the public to see it. We're seeing a picture here of the exhibition hall, a play that was put on by this artist group. And interestingly enough, the program or the publication to celebrate this was also designed by Peter Brenz. We see examples of here, not only his typeset that he had designed, but also just the ornamentation around the imagery framing the the publication. And also we see here on the left-hand side of note is this this image or this metaphor here of the diamond or crystal being showcased. And this became a symbol for this artist community of this taking a piece of carbon or coal, and through the application of pressure these kind of industrial processes creates this this diamond or this precious jewel that then becomes a beacon or a light for the rest to kind of follow their example. So Peter Brenz was self-taught as an architect. As I mentioned before, he was only trained classically in painting. He had some experience, though, beyond painting, creating some jewelry, crockery. He worked for these workshops in Munich, creating objects for sale, this kind of consumerism, mass-produced objects that the industries were creating. And so this was quite lucrative as a form of income. And this is, as many of the other artists of the time, this is one of the primary ways that he would make his way. We see here, in addition to the design for the opening, he also created a publication about his house, just to promote as well as kind of describe the ideas behind the design of his house. We see here the cover image, which also has, again, this very stylized image that accentuates the line. And as you see here by the title, Peter Brenz's house. And this really laid out within this booklet the design concepts behind it, which we're going to get into here today, as well as the plans of the house, and even listed at its tail end, interestingly enough, the manufacturer's names of all the furniture that was within the house. As I mentioned before, this housing community of these seven artists, one of the things they were tasked with was to create the smallest possible size house that was still adaptable for an average size family of the time. And this idea of creating the smallest possible size is an interesting design challenge in that it forces you as an architect or as a designer to think and to consider what is the essential elements that are necessary in a design of a house. What things do we need to include? And by extension, what things can be eliminated that maybe aren't essential or necessary? And so it's this working the design down to this core element or this core concept is the thought process behind these artists that were creating these houses that they were tasked with. But this is a theme that we're going to see going forward in some of these other houses that we'll be looking at in this course, is a similar approach to this idea of trying to get at the essence of a dwelling or the essence of a house. Which is partly why I also threw the poll question out at the start of the lecture here today, is to try to find where you guys land on what you see as the definition of a house or the core principles of what a house provides or offers. as we mentioned, as we see with Peter in his house, he was trying to define it as a work of art, this concept of a total work of art. And so we see here an image from the time when during the opening of his house in 1901, and you can see these large banners draped here at the front of the street, creating kind of an entrance points onto his property to where the house is located, but more importantly, creating this visual element, this verticality or this linear line element that it flows in a very kind of Art Nouveau way, this fashion of the time, this arts and crafts that we're also seeing carried through in the house itself, in the brickwork on the front facade, as well as the roof line on top. And so we see this banner that is more traditionally what he's familiar with as an artist, much like this poster here on the left-hand side here. This image was one of the posters that was promoted for this colony, also another design by Peter Brenz, using similar characteristics as far as the stressing the verticality, the narrow proportion to its height, as well as also the figure here holding up a jewel here at the top, this same type metaphor that we saw earlier with the diamond. But this idea that of taking these elements that are more understood as works of art and incorporating that into the building to where the building becomes more than just a built structure, but becomes a work of art in and of itself. So we see as we get closer here, return here back to the front door again, this idea of a work of art is more than just a decoration or ornamentation of the structure. It's he's thinking of it in a spatial aspect of the spaces that are defined by the house, and that goes all the way from the landscaping that surrounds the house to the front entry that we're seeing here as well. That's defined here by this inlay here on the ground that kind of creates and defines this space just adjacent to the front door. But it then extends and continues on within the house to every piece of furniture throughout the house where every detail is planned to a certain harmony to work together in concert to create this, not only this total work of art, but also this palpable or concrete atmosphere that he's trying to create. And so we see here, you can see that the ornamentation or at the street level here, the piers and the fencing, as well as the steps that work down the hillside, he's taking advantage of the terrain as far as the changes in elevation. To create this sense of space or this atmosphere around the house that's accentuated by the house transition and corners as it folds around to where all the way down to within the interior of the house to the smallest of details such as these ornament objects, combs and hair pieces for the lady of the house. But interestingly enough, what was praised about the house by the critics, the historians and the architectural critics of the time, was this austerity of the exterior. This is what really appealed to them the most, more so than this arts and crafts type ornamentation that we're seeing of the line. It was this the white that was filling in between the lines was really quite bold at the time. It dispensed in a sense of the ornamentation of the structure and really accentuated these plain white fields or planar surfaces on the structure. And this really kind of spoke to a new form of kind of rationale or modernity, where you would limit the aesthetic aspect as compared to the more decorative arts that we see flourishing in some of the other designs around this community by the architect Ulbricht. And so as we see here a little bit closer up on the front gables, You can see the brickwork that kind of defines the perimeter edge of the boundaries, so to speak, of the house. But then it also fills in these white spaces that kind of fill in between these lines. And by doing so, these curved line surfaces here create also the white surface to be quite accentuated also in this curved profile. So it becomes a question at this point whether or not the line or the curved line that he's trying to accentuate is really defined by the brickwork or whether it's defined by this white plane. This is something that was taken, we're going to see here going forward, was taken further by the houses subsequently, the designers, the architects working in this region. But this was really one of the precursors was this house here to kind of establish this principle of this space. We see by contrast, if we go around the back of the house, you can see the brickwork in the back is handled more traditionally in these upright, straight, rectilinear forms in these piers. And in this case, they're doing so structurally to support the upper level of the house. Even the cornice along here is also handled in a very more traditional fashion as compared to the front of the house. And so then we get, as a result of this, we get this house that has almost two faces or two sides. And they complement as well as contrast with each other between one side where the brick is being used as a structural element or material, and then on the front side, it's being used more as an artistic material, much the same way a painter would use paint. Also to the point here, if we get in a little bit closer and we take a look at the brickwork, you can see the lines that are drawn with the brick. Not only the horizontal lines, striations that are happening with the mortar joints, but also the vertical lines and the way that the bricks are formed in this circular fashion and laid. But also even on the surface of the brick, the glazing that's being used, creating another layer of this pattern and line that really creates kind of the liveliness that brings these piers to life. And it's this kind of very inventive kind of use of these bricks in a very artistic way, more so than just as a structural method to hold the house up, that he's emphasizing here. And creating almost a stylization of these materials. Very common materials, brick and stucco and plaster, but doing so in a very artistic way. And this goes back to his book that he published. The first sentence here I'll read for you in reference to this. He says that architecture means building art, and he unites in its name two terms, the art of skill, what's referred to as the mastery of the practical and useful subject, and the art of beauty. And so here we see in his booklet about his house, the very first sentence, he's laying out this critical distinction in architecture being made up of these two principles, this concept of the practical as well as the beautiful. And this is really what we're seeing in his house with this brickwork as an example on the front of trying to create, use these bricks in a very practical way to support structurally the house, but at the same time, in a very beautiful way to create a piece of artwork. But as he goes on to speak here in his booklet, and also another thing that really caught the attention of the critics at the time, of historians on architecture, was his approach to this concept of interrelated spaces, or the possibility of of the people that live within the house to move about freely within the house, separate from each other, individually in room to room, without disturbing one room to the next, but at the same time offering the possibility where the rooms can be combined or juxtaposed with each other. And this was an idea that really intrigued Peter, to where he felt like this was viewing the house in a different form of conceptual space, this kind of fluidity of the house, to where the spaces could interact and flow between each other, but at the same time be adaptable to accommodate a privacy from room to room, or separation when needed within the family for different functions, different uses. And so the question is, how does he accomplish this? And so if we take a look at the ground floor plan of the house, you can see here, interestingly enough, this is his entire plot that his house sits on. And you can see the front street here that we were just looking at images of here, the gate that brings you down to the front door here at this position. But then also at this front stoop that you arrive at the front door, there's a set of stairs that lead off to the right and to the left. The left goes around here to the side to a garden in the back of the house. And over here onto the right is another path that leads around to the right side, working its way down to the back garden as well. But if we enter into the entry here, into the front hall of the house, we see a set of stairs that lead up to the second floor. But off to the left, if you go up two sets of stairs here, you arrive at the music chamber, or the music room here on the left-hand side. Just above that, another set of stairs brings you up into the dining room that sits here, that also has a bayed windows here on the left-hand side that has the view out over the gardens on the exterior. We'll get into that a little bit more here in a minute. But also, this connection here, this opening that we have here between the dining room and the music room, as well as the front entryway, these large framed openings that you're passing through here. If you look closely, you can see this light line here are actually sliding doors, or pocket doors, that pocket back into the walls. And so he has, within these large cased openings, he has doors concealed within the walls that he could close if he, for example, was entertaining some guests in the music room. He could close off the doors and create a private, smaller venue for his music, or he can open them up and then create a much larger space that flows into the dining room. And so this was one of his ways of trying to make the space adaptable within the house by the use of these pocket sliding doors. And by doing so, we see the house really kind of take on a different type of approach of this flowing continuous space through the house, but then also has a more traditional a private segregation of rooms that we're familiar with. And this is really kind of a principle that the modernists in the 20th century are going to pick up and run with, is this sense of kind of continuous open flowing space that we see him playing with here early on. We also see, if we look a little bit closer here, this within the music room, we see an axis that's created here from the entryway where we have this niche kind of recessed, pocketed back in here to create, as you come into the entranceway and you arrive at the hall and you turn, this niche kind of is a point that's focused frames of view through this doorway that he's using not only for controlling the space as far as the flow, but he's also using it to control the vista, or the view through the space, almost as a frame that frames this this view at the end of the room. Here we're seeing that vista that of this view that's framed. We can see a painting that's placed in this niche. This is a painting by Peter Brenz as well. It's called A Dream. This was done in 1897, a few years before the house was built. And it's really kind of the focal point or the centerpiece of the room. We see, being a music room, we see the piano, some stands here for music. But more significantly, we see just the decoration and the stylization, again, of this linear vertical line that's also repeating within the room, within the objects of the room, as well as on the walls that we're seeing here. And even the line carried into on the ceiling is also accentuated here. Interestingly enough, this is a black and white photograph, but the decoration of the room was used on the floor, a very dark kind of inlay dark wood, as well as in the furniture itself. You can see the pieces were dark furniture, dark wood, varnished black. The ceiling was clad in gold, which created a little bit of a little bit more light or carried the light in the room. And also the walls were clad in red and yellow marbles. And so we really see here kind of the three colors of the Germanic people, again, creating this this narrative or this this sense of national kind of community. If we look over to the window, the drapes on the window, we also see, again, the way the drapes are hung. We see lines created within the drapes, but also he pierced the drapes themselves with little pinhole dots or holes that would emit light through the drapes, creating kind of like this lit or kind of backlit illuminated effect on the drapes, to where the drapes no longer are just functioning solely as a drape to block out the light, but the light actually becomes part of the drape as a form of artwork or a form of kind of decoration for the room. So really every detail within the room, every piece is thought about and considered to create this this movement or this total work of art again within the house. And this is this idea of him seeing the house as a almost like as a theater, to where it's expressing the artwork in a way that the house comes to life and involves the people almost as actors within the space to awaken not only their interest within their daily lives, but also at the same time to try to elevate their lives, enrich their lives at a higher artistic level. So with that, I think we're going to take a brief break here for about 5 to 10 minutes. We'll pick back up it's 11 o'clock now, so we'll pick up. We're running a little bit behind today, so we'll pick up at 11:07, 11:08. So welcome back. Continuing on inside the house here, we're taking a look at it here at the dining room. If you recall back from the floor plan, it's just adjacent to the music room. And we see here, by contrast to the dark colors of the music room, the black, the dark black woodwork, varnish, and we see in the dining room a contrast of white furniture, as well as like the silver trimmings and furnishings in the lights and the glass lamps, flooding the room with natural light. You can even see here coming through the shades, which are more transparent, or allow the light to breathe in on the left here, and as well as on the right. These windows that the light is pouring through, again, as we saw earlier on the floor plan, give view out to the yard in the garden on the exterior. And by doing so, creates this idea of drawing the exterior into the space on the interior by having that view framed outside, making a connection from the interior to the outside. We see, if we look up at the ceiling, we can see the line work. Again, these flowing curved lines that are being accentuated on the ceiling, as we saw in the music room, as well as on the front facade. And this line work is carried through not only in the ceiling, but also on the walls and in the furnishing, the built-in pieces on the walls, in the doors, these very subtle slight arc that we're seeing that creates, again, this dynamic kind of bringing the space to life through the use of this very kind of soft organic line. Interestingly enough, the floor in this case is made with tile, a mosaic tile. And this was a strategy that was used to keep the floor cool in the summertime, or to the touch feels cool, as well as in the wintertime, when the room is heated, the tile would be a form of retaining that heat within the space in the winter. And this was also done as well through a strategy of placing the kitchen directly below the dining room in the basement. And the kitchen that we're seeing here in the basement was a functional space. But even despite it being a functional space, you can see quite a bit of time and thought was given to the design of the pieces in the kitchen. The cabinetry here, again, very strong forms and lines. The braces that are holding up the shelves within the kitchen. All of these elements stylistically creating a sense of space as a work of art. But functionally here, the kitchen producing heat directly above here is the dining room, then would heat the tile floors to keep the dining room warm in the wintertime. By contrast, the music room that we just left, the floor was not tiled. It was they used wood inlays on the floor, and that was for acoustical reasons. Being a music room, the wood inlay would have less reverberation than a masonry tile in order to kind of control the sound quality within the music room. So we see, you know, here Peter Brenn's first house, first architectural work, very sophisticated approach to his understanding of the functional aspects of the space. We also see, in contrast, this very heavy plush carpet around the table setting. Again, this layering of materials and elements in contrast to each other, juxtaposition to each other, is part of this aesthetic that he is carrying through the house as a theme. If we take a closer look at the table, the chairs at the table, we can see there's two forms of them. There's ones without arms and that we're seeing here, and also ones with arms. But also in the chairs themselves, we see the line, this soft arced line that draws attention to itself as a line, as an element, creating this almost this gesture to the chair. Again, it's also an elongated line, stressing the verticality element of it, but also in the back that continues down into the leg, this uninterrupted continuation here becomes a line that creates a feel for the chair, or creates a chair that not only functions as a chair, but again, speaks to this idea of it being a piece of art, a work. Even to the point you can see kind of this along the edge of the line here, the reveal that's placed in it to create a shadow line along the edge to further accentuate the chair. And so then by contrast as well as complementary, the chairs with the arms, a similar approach. The backs have the same aesthetic to tie them together, but we see in profile these arms coming down and taking the shape to where they almost are reaching out and embracing the sitter that's going to sit upon the chair and envelop them within the space of the seat. The carvings that are in the arms, done in such a way that it creates this shadow line here that just accentuates the profile of the edge, the linear aspect that defines the space of the chair. We see that, again, that the style, again, create this idea of a total work of art carried all the way down to the furnishings on the table. This creamery here, as well as a teapot. Also, again, the line carried through it in a vertical orientation or fashion. All of these pieces were created for that, were designed and created specifically for the house to work in concert, or as in a whole, as a grouping, to create this idea of a total piece. The house itself, in all of these parts and components, are not seen individually, but as seen as a complete work. The glasses here, rimmed in gold, to pick up from the gold inlays on the ceilings. Even the plates, again, accentuating the line. The silverware, the elongation of within the forks of creating these very narrow, slender points that create this stretch or this linear aspect, the verticality to the piece that's reflected throughout the house to tie it all together. In Bren's mind, these manufactured objects that we're looking at here, the teapots and the plates and the silverware, are objects that are now being manufactured in an industrial process, but they still come, they're still being handled by the hand of the artist, not only in the ideas behind them, but also in the way that they're handling the design of them to try to elevate this artistic aspect that's beyond just mere functional aspect of a fork, but to create this feel and this image that speaks to something else other than just the mere practicality of the object. And this was done because of this belief that these manufactured objects that come into close contact with people in their daily lives, by having these works in their daily lives, in use daily, gives them a richer experience or a richer form in their life beyond just the ornamentation. Here we can see the tablecloth and the napkins that were also for the dining room set. Again, accentuating the line. The blue color of the tablecloth here is repeated in some of the china. This jug here that's used, the cobalt blue glaze that's applied here in a relief type fashion with like a salted glaze type firing to get this special finish on the, but as well as also the pewter lids that are attached to it. Again, all this kind of the detailing and the ornamentation on it speaking to this more industrial type process in the materials. Finally, one last piece here, a goblet that you can see from the exterior, a relief pattern design, very similar to what we've seen in his posters celebrating this artist community, this kind of this gem or object being held up as a beacon by these vertical lines again. But also we see from the inside here, you can see how that image is created by stamping, imprinting within this metal cup. And so again, it speaks very clearly and obviously to the method and the way it's made, this machine process, but at the same time it's done the line as well as the geometry, even the profile of the cup is handled in a very sophisticated, intentional way to create a piece that then has its own air of a work of art, not just merely a machined process. So if we continue on up the stairs here to the second floor, we arrive at the center hall here. And off down below here, two entryways, much the same way that we had in the lower level. Over top of the entryway is a library for the master of the house, as well as also his study off to the left here, directly above the music room down below. And so we see in a similar way these spaces flowing together and opening up together. If we continue down around the hall here, we have the lady of the house, her bedroom, as well as off to the side, her child's room. And these two rooms are connected together as one large room, but there also is a curtain that can be pulled between them for some separation or isolation between the two. Handling very much in the same way down below with the sliding doors. A similar concept, but up here, a little bit more informal with a curtain to the sliding doors down below. And then also finally on the far right corner here is the man of the house's bedroom, and his room also connected between a direct door between the lady's room and his room. Again, this idea of this flowing space that can also be closed off for privacy. And then finally, also the off to the side here, a shared bathroom, bath as well as a toilet shared by the three bedrooms. So we can see here also, interestingly enough, the differentiation, even the way that the rooms are handled. Off to the left here is the ladies' room on the first floor, where you can see the type of decoration and ornamentation and the way that it's handled, very more rectilinear, traditional in its fashion. compared to on the right-hand side, the library up on the second floor for the man of the house. You can see even on the left-hand side, his bookcases. Again, the very soft kind of like arced line mimics the same type of vocabulary that we're seeing in the other elements of the house, pulling them together, as well as that line being repeated down in the floor, the rug on the floor, as well as the inlays on the ceiling. And off to the side here, the window that looks out from his desk, out over the front entryway to the street, the arced line across the top head of the window here, the bay window that he's looking out. Interestingly enough, also the chair, similar to the dining chair, the arced arms of the chair coming down in a very similar fashion to the dining set. One thing I'll point out here, just a side note, this idea of these flowing spaces was not a new idea by Peter Brentz. This had been done before. The French were notorious for this. They have this concept of enfilade, which is where the rooms are connected one to the other without a hall between them. So you move from one room to the next, and very much similar, he's handling it in this regard. But in his case, what made this house unique was not only the use of this French concept of tying these together. A word actually also of interest, enfilade is a word that comes from the old French, which is refers to a thread, and a thread being a form of a tie, and so it's this idea that the rooms are tied together by this connection between them, or a thread between them, but it's not only this connection, but it's also the arrangements of the rooms to each other. Here we're seeing on the second floor his positioning of these pieces together enable this ability to have a flowing continuous space, or combine spaces together, whereas the study, for example, in the library read as one larger space, or at the same time the ability to close off those connections or those threads through these sliding doors or curtains to compartmentalize these rooms into a smaller space. And this kind of handling of space or manipulating of space is really is at the heart of what made this house of interest to his contemporaries at the time. Here we're seeing a look at the bathroom. You can see the bath here, again, also handled in a very simple, clean aesthetic, but at the same time, clearly intended as far as attention to detail and ornament. From a stylistic or an artistic fashion. Going back downstairs to the dining room, I wanted to point out this, looking out towards the bay windows that look out into the garden, this idea, again, of these spaces that flow together, as well as these vistas, this concept of framing a view. In this case, in the dining room, he's framing the view of the garden, and bringing the garden into the space enables the space to become much larger in its sense of space, because you mentally envision this garden being a part of the room, in your experience of the room, by these vistas. And by doing so, he's amplifying within the house the effect of this space. And one last note here that I wanted to leave with here as an example is the music room, which is the most prominent room of the house. If you recall back here on the floor plan, where we have from the entry hall through this passageway that's framing the view of the niche and his painting on the wall. If you stand at the painting and you look back through this framed opening, it frames the view of the stairs that we're seeing here on the right-hand side. And then by extension, the windows up on the stairs, again, much like in the dining room, they open up the view to the exterior to where you get this endless vista that's framed by the doors, these sliding doors that we're seeing here, but then also framed by the window beyond and then further out into the garden. And it's this idea, as in his own words, he said, if you follow with the eye from the piano niche of the music room, the axis which through the width of the music room leads down the landing and the staircase window on the west wall, a very extensive space, is covered in proportion to the total dimensions of the house, that although it extends through different spaces, is summarized through the architectural medium in a certain way. And so it's this idea that even though this kind of vista or this view is passing through multiple spaces and multiple elements, all of these elements are pulled together by the design of their works and their treatment of the materials, but also in the arrangement of those spaces through these axes or vistas that enable the space to read as a whole, as a complete continuation. And it's this idea of this whole continuation, this total work of art, is really at the heart of what he's trying to accomplish with the arrangement of the house here. And so with that, we'll wrap it up and have a couple minutes here if there's any questions out there. I noticed during the break, there was a question asking to the cost of the house. At the time that he built it, it was of the seven artist houses that were built, it was the most expensive one, and he spent 200,000 marks on the house at the time to complete it. So you would have to go back and do some calculation to bring that up to today's time as far as cost. But needless to say, at the time, it was a great expense. And it was significantly more than was spent on the other artist houses in the community. If there's any other questions, feel free to unmute yourself. Yes. I believe it's preserved as not as a museum per se, but the community, I think, as an exhibition, much kind of what it was initially intended for, to kind of showcase this period of time. But I'm not 100% certain on that. I'd have to check to be certain. I don't know the answer to that one. That's a good question. I'd have to look into that one and get back to you. Sure. Yeah, so the great question. All of the elements of the house, everything about it, including the rugs, was designed by Peter Brenz. So it was a complete work of art by a single artist. Many of the pieces were made and manufactured, again, not by his own hand, working with different furnishing manufacturers, but here he's acting as the artist. And in this case, in this way, by being the sole kind of artist of all these pieces, if you go beyond his houses and you look at some of his later work, where he got into more commercial architecture, factories, a lot of these industrial factories that were online at this time, which he became known for as well, even more so than the house itself. With those factories, he encompassed not only the design of the factories and the layout of the factories, much like we're seeing in looking at the house today, but he also designed all of the furnishings and elements of those factories, the lamps, the lights, all of the various fans and operations and that type of thing. But then he also went all the way down to designing the stationery for the company, their typeset lettering, every aspect to what we consider today more kind of in the idea of branding, that where a company tries to brand themselves commercially to be recognizable as a particular thing, and that's done through stylizing their products along with their ads and the way that they present themselves publicly. This was all stuff that Peter Brenz was doing and is really kind of considered one of the first kind of industrial designers that kind of created this concept of commercial branding for corporations. And we're seeing in this house, which is why this house is so significant, this concept and idea applied to a house before he applied it to these more commercial buildings that he became known for as this first industrial designer. But like in the rugs, as you pointed out, the tableware, the lights, the lamps, everything is kind of designed by his own hand. And also as these various vocabulary of these curved lines pulls it all together almost in a branding type fashion. Oh, great. Thanks for getting into that, Larry. So the house only took about a year to build. There was actually kind of a rush. When the artists were brought in by the Duke in 99, or invited to come in, they worked on the design and then they built it in about a year's time to have it ready for the opening in 1901. Some of the houses, actually Peter Brenz's house, one of which weren't completely done at the time of the opening. There was still some furnishing work that was needed to be done on the interior. But it was complete in about a year's time as far as the construction of it, equally as far as the design work as well. And then he only lived in the house, actually, unfortunately, about 2 years after it was completed, before he moved on elsewhere to take advantage of work in other cities. So there weren't back stairs. You can actually see here on the floor plan, the dining room here, and the staircase set up just adjacent to it. I'm not entirely sure about Dunware. I would suspect there would be somewhere in this area here that you would take advantage of something like that to be able to service the food up to the ground floor. Great questions. So if there aren't any more, we'll wrap it up and adjourn next week. Very good. Well, we'll see you next week. We'll be taking a look at, I mentioned earlier, Antonio Gaudi's Casa Batlló, one of my personal favorites. And we'll see some interestingly enough, I mean, this is a house that we looked at here today in Germany. Gaudi was practicing down in Barcelona, a little bit removed from Germany. He was building Casa Batlló, as we'll see, around the same time period. But it's interesting to see the connections and the threads between the house today and the house we'll see next week, despite the fact that they're disconnected geographically and even just awareness. Interestingly enough, I'll point out one last thing here, that within Peter Brenn's studio, his commercial studio, after he completed this house and he got larger commissions as an architect, with the success of his house, he started to be hired, not just as an artist, but as an architect, hired to design these factories and for these industrial plants. And one of those factories that he became most known for, that he built in 1909 to 1910, at the time that he was designing that factory and working on the construction of it, he had three individuals that were working in his office under his apprenticeship, by the name of Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier, and Walter Gropius, three heavyweights of the modern movement in the mid-century. And so all three of these guys were very much influenced by Peter Brenn's work and his philosophy and his concepts, him being kind of their senior. And so a lot of these ideas that we saw here today were kind of like the precursors to some of these modern concepts later in the century. And that's really kind of the thrust of this course, is that we'll see kind of like these ideas carry through from time to time, from house to house, by these kind of associations. And despite Gaudi's was never really associated with Brenn's, really kind of the zeitgeist of the time, of the culture, still permeates and carries through to where they're both wrestling with kind of a similar idea of this, the industrial takeover of the arts and crafts. So thanks for tuning in, and look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you. Oh, what's that? Yes. Yeah, I'm certain that they did see the house. I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I can't imagine that they wouldn't have. The house was quite received well and published quite a bit. So I suspect that they did take it in, if not at the opening, but at subsequently. Good question. I'll have to look into that one though for next week. Thank you. Thanks.